could very easily, just like as in the case of Iraq, be just an excuse to be as intrusive as possible in Iran's internal affairs.
We could find absolutely no bullet impacts at all. So the question then becomes, were the U.S. being fired upon, or was it just rock throwing?
There are many organizations here, especially in America, which is a place where the most reactionary and pro-CIA and U.S. imperialist groups come and live.
The for now part of it is also very, very important because it by no means follows that every liberation is followed by a foundation of freedom.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, June 17th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. troops intent on crushing resistance pushed ahead today with sweeps that have grabbed more than 400 Iraqis, while the American military reported that a sniper had gunned down one of its soldiers in Baghdad with a single shot in his back. In London, two former cabinet ministers charged that their government had selectively used intelligence about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction to justify war. Also, a British newspaper cited a senior military official as saying coalition forces still had to prove to Iraqis that Saddam Hussein's regime was dead. Meanwhile, the International Atomic Energy Agency is charging that Iran has failed to report all of its nuclear activity, and pressure is mounting on Tehran to grant UN inspectors access to all nuclear facilities. The White House says that Iran is using its civilian nuclear program as a cover for secretly developing nuclear weapons. But according to Ross Porzal, Washington-based political analyst and member of the Alliance of Progressive Iranians, many questions about Iran's military capabilities remain shrouded in secrecy, and the U.S. may be using weapons of mass destruction as a convenient excuse for launching attacks, despite a lack of evidence to back up its claims.
I do think that if Iran has a nuclear weapons program, that it should come clean, so to speak. It should open up and reassure the international community. That's a big if. I would also add to that that very, very few people know whether Iran has a secret nuclear weapons program. This could very easily, just like as in the case of Iraq, be just an excuse for the U.S., in particular for the Pentagon, which has basically hijacked U.S. foreign policy, to be as intrusive as possible in Iran's internal affairs. I do trust the U.N. more than I trust the U.S. However, let's remember that in the case of Iraq, it was years of UN sanctions and then renewed UN inspections that basically paved the way for the U.S. to attack Iraq. If the UN hadn't been allowed in there to determine that for sure Iraq couldn't defend itself, the U.S. may have been more hesitant to attack Iraq. Now on to the case of Iran. I think the best thing for the U.S. to do, if in fact nuclear weapons is an issue, it would be to be less threatening and less aggressive to the Third World and to the Middle East, and in particular to Iran. As we saw in the case of North Korea recently, having a nuclear weapon is in fact a deterrent. And in countries such as Israel and India, which are not known to be great friends of the Muslim world, opinion makers in recent years expressed grave concern about the aggressive posture of the United States toward the Muslim world because, they said, it will encourage the development of weapons of mass destruction. This was brought out specifically, especially when the U.S. Attacked Serbia in the case of Kosovo. So I think rather than debate the question of whether Iran is working on nuclear weapons or not, which would be a conjecture in any case on the part of any of us, I think the real issue is that other countries are entitled to feel secure from aggression, and that the U.S., instead of listening to the neoconservatives and lobbies in Washington that advocate that any kind of détente with independent nations of the world is appeasement, rather than doing that, I think that we should recognize that they have as much right to feel secure as we do here.
So when you say that, do you mean they basically, Iran has as much right, North Korea has as much right, Syria or anybody else on the planet has as much right to have a nuclear weapons program as the U.S. or Israel or others?
Well, yes and no. I don't think it's in the interest of Iran to devote its resources to useless things like military expenditure like we do in this country. I mean, money could be put to better uses. However, it's in the nature of any nation and any government to want to protect itself. I don't defend the domestic policies of Iran's government. However, I think it has behaved for many years now quite rationally in the international arena. In fact, very recently, many times Iranian leaders, top leaders, have said that they want all of the Middle East to be a nuclear-free zone or a weapons WMD-free zone. In other words, meaning that let's disarm Israel and Pakistan and India and whoever else simultaneously. I think that's a very good position to take, rather than say that all of us should have nuclear weapons.
I don't see too many actually going down that path at this time. In fact, U.S. officials are also pushing for a vote to censure Iran at a meeting of the IAEA that's currently taking place in Vienna. If that fails, the U.S. says it will bring up the issue before the U.N. Security Council in the fall. Just how much pressure is the international community under or by the U.S. to act on Iran's alleged threat? And how much credibility does the U.S. maintain, given that weapons of mass destruction still haven't been found in Iraq?
Well, exactly. You put your finger on it. First of all, the U.S. does have tremendous influence, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, since we live in a unipolar world now, and we are by far the greatest military power on the face of the earth. Not only military institutions, but even institutions such as the World Bank and the IMF and the rest basically toe the America's line. It's called the Washington Consensus. I mean, the gamut basically is from globalization to militarization of foreign policy. I don't have to tell you that. The UN is very much intimidated by the United States, even though countries did speak up in the case of Iraq, didn't go anywhere. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if the United Nations and the IAEA go along slowly setting the stage. This is the very same process that we went through, exactly, step by step, in the case of Iraq. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if they yield to pressure from the United States and go along. Of course, I should say that the European Union, even though it has very good relations with Iran and, in fact, is trying to be a counterbalance in the region to U.S. influence by warming up to Iran. Nevertheless, it does have concerns because, of course, they are also, more than any other region in the world, Europe has common interests with the United States. I mean, that's historical and based on many, many other facts, such as the flow of capital in the world. But they will go along.
Mm-hmm. You think they will go along with the vote to censure Iran, the IAEA?
Well, they're also trying to pressure Iran to yield to more intrusive inspections. And I think that one or the other will succeed. I think this is a trap from which it would be very hard for Iran to escape, especially considering that there is tremendous domestic pressure also building within Iran. So
should Iranians start to dig bunkers and expect a shock and awe program launched at their country as well?
I don't think it's imminent. It took many, many years, as you know, to basically change the regime in Iraq. And this process will also go through its logical steps, so to speak. Overthrowing Iran's regime, however, will be, in the end, less complicated than Iraq because Iran is not a military dictatorship. It's not a very closed society. And we know from experiences like Nicaragua and Chile and the rest that when a society is more open and allows conflict between different social forces, that it's easier for it to become prey to U.S. pressure or intervention. So I think in the end, Iran is both an easier and a more difficult prey to American intervention.
Easier and more difficult.
Yes, well, it's easier because of the reason that I said, and that is a more dynamic society and it's less of a dictatorship than Iraq. I mean, it's easier to infiltrate Iran than it was in Iraq. One of the reasons that, in fact, the U.S. had to overthrow the Iraqi regime, as well as in some other countries, is that it had so little influence. It was so difficult for the U.S. and its ally, Israel, to infiltrate Iraq. And we tried for many, many years to assassinate Saddam, and we didn't succeed. We didn't have good intelligence assets and the ability to infiltrate there. Mm-hmm. But it's easier to do that in Iran because public opinion is quite divided.
And also, there's a history of political manipulation on the part of the U.S. and Iran when we think back to the Shah.
Right, absolutely. When you hear about this group of former high government officials and the big businessmen, Iranians, who are assembled in Los Angeles in big numbers, who are now working with the neoconservatives and the Israel lobby and with the Pentagon to overthrow the regime in Iran, when you think about it, you realize that this is the same class in Iran that supported the Shah and profited from the Shah's rule, and that, in fact, this is the same class that were returned to prominence and power in 1953 by the CIA coup, and that the revolution of 1979 was a broad popular effort to get rid of them, and that's what they had to flee Iran. So it's like history repeats itself. Mm. Like, once again, parts of the administration and the corporate community in the U.S. are trying to repeat 1953. Therefore, of course, if that succeeds in the future, we will have another revolution quarter century down the road. So, neocons really like to tell us, such as Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post and the rest, that there's no price for hegemony and domination. I remember during the Afghanistan campaign, they said, all this Arab street rage and the rest is a fable, and that we privately we have a lot of admiration and support among the people in the Middle East. And they said, remember back when in the Gulf War of 1991, everybody warned that this was going to be disastrous and so on. You see, nothing happened. I mean, they look at only the short term. If you consider that reactions are delayed and come back to haunt the United States, then you realize that we just keep doing the same thing over and over, and then we act surprised when it comes back and hits us in the face.
Some would say that September 11th happened, and that was a backlash to this hegemony and dominance on the part of the U.S.
I have no doubt about that. But, I think the American public are lulled, basically, into thinking that there's no price to pay for intervention. We go in there and you see how before the Afghanistan war, there were just tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating in the Middle East, in the streets in Pakistan, and you see how it all died down after we started bombing Afghanistan. It's a very, very superficial way of looking at things to think that because people go home after you start bombing, that therefore it's over. And then, of course, later when you have a group like Al-Qaeda that has very, very broad popular support in the Middle East among the poorer classes, then when it asserts itself and attacks U.S. interests, then you call them terrorists and you say that, they don't have a popular base and they're extremists and so on and so forth. It's a whole elaborate ideology, which I'm sure you're aware of.
Ross Porzal is a Washington-based political analyst and member of the Alliance of Progressive Iranians. Tomorrow, in part two of our discussion with Porzal, some very surprising revelations about Iranians' sentiments around a possible U.S. invasion in that country. The Bush administration's credibility was dealt a serious blow by the failure of American troops troops to uncover weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, as the U.S. presses for tougher weapons inspections in Iran, many international observers are questioning just how valid U.S. claims are or whether it really has ulterior motives. Samin Royanian, a Kurdish-Iranian economist and the co-founder of Women for Peace and Justice in Iran, spoke of the U.S. motives at the End the War Network's fourth national grassroots organizing conference on Iraq, held several weeks ago in College Park, Maryland.
Just as they did with Iraq, the U.S. are talking with Iranians outside Iran who are opposed to the Islamic Republic. And it's important for the American peace and justice movement to recognize that whoever is opposed to the Islamic rule in Iran is not supporting the human rights of the people of Iran. Many of them, just like the Iraqis, are working hand in hand with CIA, with the State Department, in order to take control of Iran and steal some more of the resources and wealth of the Iranian people who are suffering today in Iran from economic trouble, social trouble, and under the dictatorship of the Islamic Republic. The other week, there was a demonstration in Washington by a group that said they are fighting for freedom for Iran. They are called the Mujahideen, Khalq of Iran. They have never believed in peace. They worked with Saddam Hussein against the people of Iran, against the Kurds. They shot the people of Iran and the Kurdish people when the war was going on between Saddam Hussein and Iran. And now they are in trouble because America, who at one time was their friend, now considers them terrorists. And they're trying to play up. And the peace movement need to know who these different organizations are. There are many organizations here, especially in America, which is a place where the most reactionary and pro-CIA and U.S. imperialist groups come and live. Because the United States of government does not give refugee status to the communists or the leftist people or the freedom-loving people of Iran who were tortured and killed and then exiled, some of them. They live in Europe. America does not give a refugee status to those who fight against imperialism. So the same way that we have the Cubans in Florida, we have the Iranian in Los Angeles, we have Zionist Iranian organization that supports the Sharon policy in Middle East. It calls itself Mehr Iran, love for Iran. And it says that it's working for the human rights of the Iranian people. And the only thing they do is they promote some of the killings of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is against the human rights of the people of Iran, in order to promote their Zionist agenda for Iran. There are organizations here which work with the monarchies. There are organizations which work with Shah Soan. There are many different Iranian academicians who are in the different universities, and they talk on the lines which are in the interest of American imperialism. And they write at this point how they suffered through the war between Iran and Iraq and why Saddam Hussein is such a monster, and so on that basis they support the invasion of Iraq. We have to be very conscious of who these people are, and when we want to move on, when Iran comes under attack, we must not listen to these individuals, to this kind of organizations that are promoting the interests of U.S. imperialism in Middle East, the interests of Zionism and Israeli politics in Middle East, in the name of human rights for the people of Middle East. The most important human right for any person on this earth is the right to live, first and foremost. If we go and bomb them and kill them, we cannot talk about their human rights. First and foremost, we have to stop this government from killing the people of Middle East. And they know what human rights are. The people of Iran are very sophisticated. They have been working for 25 years against the Islamic Republic of Iran and gaining many rights. There is a very big, flourishing, interesting civil society, democratic movement in Iran among the women, among the students, among the workers, and they are going to get the rights if nobody bombs them.
Samin Royanian is a Kurdish-Iranian economist and the co-founder of Women for Peace and Justice in Iran. Thanks to Matt Bradley, Avishay Artsy, and Reem Kathuda from Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington for preparing that segment. Well, with the military phase of the war officially over in Iraq and the Ba'ath Party out of power, many expatriates are now returning to their native land. Among them are London-based Iraqis Samir and Susan, who are brother and sister. Each of them have good memories of life in Iraq, and they say they want to go back to commemorate their dead and help to rebuild Iraq's infrastructure. Iraq is where they feel they belong.
I left Iraq because of the political reason, and I do miss it too much when I fled from my country and be in exile for 23 years. So I really miss Baghdad.
I am an Iraqi, arrived here actually 14 years ago and applying for asylum when I've been granted full refugee status due to my special case. Still within these 14 years, I always dreaming to go or to see at least my country or motherland.
You can't imagine. Now I lost my father, my brother, my cousin, but I still want to go. I want just to smell the rivers of Tiger and you. This is my, you can't imagine.
I am going back for many reasons. First of all, because I love my motherland, I love my people, and I'm very keen to go back to my place where I growing up. I have a lot of relatives there. I am capable to contribute to rebuild my country. So we have to contribute to rebuild the structure of the Iraqi human, not only the building, which is more difficult. And we are sure we are going to reestablish our country as a civil country. It may not have 100% democracy, but at least we have a civil way to manage our life.
We used to have very close friends, even our neighbors. So we miss that. Iraqi miss their lifestyle because the British society are more individual. My next door doesn't know my name until after 1 year. I start to invite her, I start to bring her some food in order to have some relation.
I have obligation to give respect to my dad, my brother, my uncle, and my six cousins who've been executed as well. We are one of the families who pay a lot of price for against Saddam Hussein, because none of our extended family joined Ba'ath Party, which annoying Saddam personally.
I would like to go to Iraq, of course, now. You know, we lost 9 members of our family. I discovered the grave of my brother, the youngest brother. He was 19 years old when he was arrested. They gave me the number of the grave, which make me really very tired, very sad. And I wish now just to go to smell his grave, to do what I want to do. This is my desire, really, in order to be happy after war. And then to put something in front of the house, that this is the house belonged to these people who were arrested, executed by the ex-regime. This is very important for the next generations. Any child will pass through our home. He will read these things. He will remember. It's very important not to allow for any dictator to be in power in the future.
London-based Iraqis Samir and Susan. Special thanks to Interworld Radio for producing that piece. Credibility questions notwithstanding, President Bush is riding high in U.S. public opinion polls after his invasion of Iraq, yet the success of his administration's war against terrorism is anything but certain. Recent bombings in Saudi Arabia and Morocco serve as a warning that terrorist groups such as al-Qaeda continue to operate beyond the reach of cruise missiles and laser-guided bombs. And most of the world, overwhelmingly opposed to America's war in Iraq, was not surprised to find that the weapons of mass destruction that the White House uses to justify its war in Baghdad cannot be found. Still, many citizens strongly believe that the only effective means to fight the terrorists who viciously attacked America on September 11th, as well as perceived threats from rogue states, is through war and violence. But longtime Nation magazine columnist Jonathan Schell, author of the book The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People, argues that history has shown us that there are viable alternatives to endless cycles of violence. He recently spoke with Scott Harris of the syndicated radio program Between the Lines about the many dangers now facing the world. Schell concludes that war is far from the only answer.
You know, war is always a tragedy, always a horror. As I see it, really, no war is good. Every war starts off wrong, so to speak, because it means the loss of life and injury, and is only tolerable in an extreme case when there's some kind of extraordinary justification. Ernest Hemingway said that every war is a crime, even when it is justified. I guess that expresses my feeling about war.
The Bush administration and a lot of people in this country believe that, you know, with the uncovering of thousands of bodies of people, many innocents who were executed by Saddam Hussein during his long regime, part of which, of course, he was supported by the United States. But nonetheless, people see the solution of war as being justified by Saddam's brutality. And how do you respond to that justification for war? That is often the case throughout history.
The United States went to war because it said that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction or was on its way to getting them and had to be stopped and disarmed. We went before the United Nations. We argued there for several months about that. So it's really wrong and very damaging to the entire prestige and reputation of the United States to suddenly forget about that and switch the argument. You know, when you go to war, it matters terribly what your justification is. Because war is so terrible, you have to give your reasons to the world and to your own people. So there's something deeply wrong about going to war for one reason, and then once the war has been fought, say, oh, excuse me, we were in there for another reason. Now, it's true that as a sort of secondary matter, very late in the day, the president did mention democratizing Iraq and so forth. But the plain truth of the matter is that that was an afterthought, and it was not the reason that the United States went to war. Now, as to the result, you know, however little part of the plan, certainly nobody can fail to be glad that that tyrant is gone, and especially when you see these people searching for their relatives with their own hands in mass graves. So that is something that has turned out well, at least for now. But the for now part of it is also very, very important because it by no means follows that every liberation is followed by a foundation of freedom. I mean, there are all kinds of revolutions in history of tyrants that have fallen only to leave something just as bad or worse behind. So the jury's kind of out on that at the moment.
Jonathan Schell, after September 11th, those in the peace community were advocating a less or nonviolent means to confront terrorism, the terrorism that wrought so much death and destruction here in this country in 2001. How do you respond to the idea that this dramatic strike of terrorism at the World Trade Center in New York and the Pentagon really created a situation that the United States itself had to strike out violently and that nonviolent means were really not a viable alternative?
Well, you know, if you say nonviolent, it sounds as if some people are going to go and picket the terrorists and hope they'll desist or something like that. And of course, that would be totally ridiculous. But I actually think that the problem of terrorism illustrates very, very well the virtues of an approach other than war. I mean, it does involve policing, police work. It does involve apprehending the terrorists. But this involves and requires cooperation of other countries, and especially when you are dealing with global terrorism. There's really no hope whatsoever of getting a hold of that unless you have the willing cooperation of allies, and especially in the Middle East. So if you alienate those governments, if you alienate those peoples, you're going to destroy the cooperation on which success depends. And then, of course, as people also point out, you're going to fill up the terrorist ranks with recruits who are going to be very angry. You know, when something like September 11th happens, and I happen to live six blocks from where the World Trade Center was, and so that was a shock to me personally that I will never recover from. And it creates a very natural instinct, which is an ageless instinct, you know, to strike back. But you do have to ask yourself, is that going to actually solve your problem? I mean, the Iraq War is a wonderful example of that. Most Americans thought that we were helping to solve the problem of September 11th by removing the government in Iraq. But in actual fact, there's been no linkage demonstrated between the government there and the terrorism of September 11th. So, you know, if one guy punches you, it's not helpful to punch another guy in response. That doesn't solve your problem. And that's the nature of terrorism. And it needs a response that's other than a strictly military one. If you want to solve it, I mean, maybe you'll gratify certain instincts if you hit back at somebody else who didn't do it, if you just blind yourself to reality. But you actually won't be safer at the end of the day. You'll be more vulnerable.
Jonathan Schell is author of The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People, published by Metropolitan Books. He spoke with Scott Harris of the syndicated radio program Between the Lines. You can read Schell's Nation magazine column online at www.thenation.com. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.